It's good to be back. Even better to have watched online the past couple of weeks and saw that you guys were in great hands. That Pastor April and Pastor Mike did a phenomenal job. If you didn't get a chance to listen, I encourage you to go back and listen for two reasons. One, just because I think they're both great speakers, but also it lets you know who they are, why they are on this staff, what their background is. So often I think you look up here and you think that maybe somebody up here on staff who's a pastor is some, you know, other than kind of person. No, we're just like you. And that's also what we've been trying to get across. We're very just like you in the fact that we break stuff. All right. If Jonathan's not in here, nobody needs to know. No. Anyways, I hope I didn't break that. We're looking through the book of Genesis and talking about the genesis of dysfunction. If you ever looked at your own family and thought to yourself, man, this is one dysfunctional mess. How did we get here? And then maybe someday you saw your mom or dad talking with your grandparents, and you're like, oh, that's why she's like that. Yeah, that's why. Okay. And you start to wonder maybe, like, how long has this been going on? You realize this has been going on all the way back in time, all the way back to Genesis. And so we started tracing back Adam and Eve and their first sin and the dysfunction that led to Cain and Abel, their kids. And then you saw, you know, God starts over with Noah, and doesn't take very long for dysfunction to start back in with Noah and his sons. And then the book of Genesis sort of narrows in on this one family starting in Genesis 12, and we'll continue on with this one family all the way to the end of the book of Genesis. And you'll just see how the dysfunction with Abraham and Sarah just continues to grow on into Isaac and then on into Jacob and then on into, as we'll see this morning, on into the life of Joseph, how the dysfunction just keeps going and going and going. And along the way, a couple weeks ago, Pastor Alex said, well, thanks, Pastor Steve, for ruining another Bible story for me. And I sort of feel like, if you ever seen those digital shorts that's titled Adam Ruins Everything? Some of y'all might know what that is. I sort of feel like that's what this series has been, where I'm going through and talking about all of these, as we might call them, Bible heroes of the faith, and sort of tearing them down in a sense, or maybe really just telling you the rest of the story you didn't know. And we've basically been seeing is that Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, these were not good people. They just weren't. And the idea that the reason why they're in the Bible is because they were great people, and so we should hold them up and we should be like them, that's not what the scriptures is saying according to their morality or their virtue. Rather, you might say, well, then why are they in there? They're in there for this reason. Because although they weren't good people, although they made a lot of mistakes and did a lot of bad things, and they weren't people you typically want to emulate their morals or their virtues, they were people that at some point in their life, for some of them it was all the way to the end of their life, some people it was early in life, at some point in their life, they got to the point where they said, God, I can't do this anymore. It's yours. My life, it's yours. I'll go where you want me to go. Okay, God, fine. Have it your way. I will do your thing. At some point in their life, they give their life over to God and they trust God and they live by faith at some point. For some of them, it's like Isaac. It's almost like not until the end of his life that he finally gets it. He like does one thing at the end of his life. Sort of like the thief on the cross who only does one good thing and says, Jesus, remember me when you're in paradise. And this is what the book of Romans is sort of talking about. When Paul gets over the book of Romans and he's trying to explain to them about having a relationship with Jesus Christ, he's trying to show them, listen, the relationship we have with God has always been like this. And the idea that you have to be virtuously or morally good enough to earn God's favor has never been the case. Have you really read all of those Bible stories like we're trying to do right now? Which is why he starts off in the book of Romans and he says this. He says, the gospel tells us how God makes us right in his sight. The gospel, namely, that for God so loved the world that he sent his one and only son, Jesus Christ, to come into the world, not to condemn the world, but that all the world might be saved through him, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life, that whole thing from John chapter 3. He's saying the gospel, the good news, that God gives us righteousness. Well, he just credits it to us. We don't earn it. He just gives it to us. And that all comes by our faith, our love relationship with God. That's how this always comes. And so he goes on to say in Romans chapter 1, he says, this is accomplished from start to finish. When he says start to finish, he's referring to there from the start of the Bible all the way until the end of time. So from the beginning of time to the end of time, from the beginning to the end, it's always been like this. From start to finish, it's always been by faith, he says. As the scripture says, it is through faith that a person is considered righteous. And where is he quoting that from? He's quoting that from, anybody want to guess the book of the Bible? Man, I thought I was doing a better job teaching. All right, we're doing a study on the book of Genesis. Anybody want to guess where he's quoting from right here? Genesis, there we go. All right, so He's saying from start to finish, it's always been by faith, which is why I'm trying to go back and show you back in the book of Genesis, it was always through faith. These are heroes of the faith, not heroes of morality, not heroes of character. The Bible characters, by and large, are heroes of the faith. Okay, it's their faith in relationship with God, not their morality. And so as you look at these people and you go, why does God put these people in the Bible? Once again, it's their faith, not their morality. And that is also the case even with guys who are the best of moral characters, a guy like we're going to look at this morning, which is Joseph. Now, how many of y'all know anything at all about Joseph? Just raise your hand. How many of y'all don't know anything about the guy at all? Okay, well, if you know something about him, I'm going to kind of ruin some things for you this morning. If you don't know anything about him, well, then you're getting to start fresh, and that's probably a good place to start. Now, Joseph is considered, as you look at the life of Joseph, he's considered to be one of the great characters of morality and virtue in the Old Testament. He's right up there with guys like Daniel or Elijah. He's one of those people you really look to and says, be like him. As a matter of fact, when we do youth talks on morality and sexual ethics, Joseph's a guy you look to. Joseph has an opportunity at some point in his narrative you're going to read about where he has the opportunity to sleep with his master's wife because she's really coming on to him, and he looks at her, he says, I will not do such a thing, and she says, oh, come on, we're in the perfect place, perfect time, nobody will ever know, and he runs out of there. And so we talk to youth about when you're in a tempting situation, don't fight temptation, you run from temptation. You do what Joseph did, you run from temptation. Later on, what you're going to see is, we're going to be looking at Genesis 37. A lot of bad stuff happens to Joseph in Genesis 37 from his brothers. Over in Genesis chapter 50, what you see with Joseph is he forgives his brothers for all the stuff that they do to him here in chapter 37. And so we look at Joseph and you say, man, here's a guy you want to be like. You know, he doesn't hold grudges. He forgives. He has a godly perspective. Be like Joseph. Okay. Now, that's where a lot of people think of Joseph. When you think of Joseph, you think of all of that. However, when you read Genesis 37, you can't think about that Joseph from Genesis chapter 50, you got to read Joseph for who he is as a kid. And as a kid, guess what? He was a bad dude like all the other guys were bad dudes in the story. He really was. And what's the problem is, if you know the story, you'll read Genesis 37 and you'll go, oh, well, he's the good guy in the character and the other guys are the bad guys in the and you'll wash over and you'll miss what the text is actually saying. So, I need to give you a little bit more background when we pick up, because the very, very first verse of Genesis 37 is going to say this. This is the account of Jacob's family line, and it's going to go into this. So, Joseph was one of Jacob's sons. Now, if you were with us a couple weeks ago, we looked at this. You have Abraham, and then he had a son named Isaac. Isaac had a son named Jacob. Well, Jacob was a twin. Jacob had a twin brother named Esau. Esau came out just minutes before him, and so in that culture, because even though he was the oldest by almost a technicality, if you will, he was considered the eldest, the first child, and Isaac loved Esau more than he loved Jacob, and so there was this favoritism issue, and so Esau lived kind of like a very selfish, indulged life where he didn't have to take care of anything, didn't have any responsibility, and Isaac just let him run free, and so Esau became a pretty corrupt, bad kind of person. And so Jacob says it's unfair that he gets to have the rights of the firstborn and he's going to care for the family. And so he manipulates the situation along with his mother's help to sort of steal the birthright from his brother. That creates a family feud. Jacob runs off and has to start a new life for himself. Well, as often happens, whether it be young men or young women, if they don't have a sense of love from their parents, especially from their father, they look for it somewhere else in life. And so for Jacob, who always longed for the love and honor and respect from his father and never got it, he said, you know, if I can't get it from him, I'll go looking for it in a relationship, which is typically where young men and young women will go look for it. They will go look for some boy to be what their mother or father never was for them, or they'll go look for some girl to be what their mother or father wasn't for them. And so sure enough, with Jacob, he goes off and he sees this beautiful girl named Rachel. And oh man, he thinks to himself, you know, if I had her by my side, I would be somebody. People would know I am somebody. I would matter in this life. And if I could get a girl like that to love me, it doesn't matter what my parents say about me. It doesn't matter what the world says about me. Nothing else will matter. If a girl like that loves me, then everybody will know I am somebody and I'll feel like I am somebody. And so he says, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get that girl to love me and be my wife. And so he goes to her father and he says, what's it going to take? And so the father says, well, work for me for 7 years. And so sure enough, he works 7 years so he can marry her. However, he gets drunk on his wedding night, and his father, or their father-in-law-to-be, slips a different woman in the room with him, and he ends up waking up next to Leah, which is her older sister. And Leah was, let's just say, not a looker like Rachel was. Now, by the way, side story, I know I gave Leah a hard time. If you missed it in the story, later on through the lineage, if you trace back in the book of Matthew, the lineage of Jesus, it goes up through this family. Which wife of Jacob's do you think the lineage of Jesus falls under? Rachel or Leah? Leah. Isn't that just like God? To take the one that nobody wanted and said, I want you. I'm going to make you mine. I'm going to make you a part of my family. When nobody else wants you, I want you to know I love you and you are loved by me. And so we see in the text, God does love her, even though Jacob doesn't seem to along the way. So let's move on. Focus back in. So now let's say you're Jacob. You have wanted to marry this girl, Rachel, because she's the one who's going to make you somebody. She's going to make you a man in this world. You worked for 7 years and you got fooled. So you had to work another 7 years and you finally get to marry her. How much do you think he's excited to be with her? Okay. Well, they struggle with infertility. Meanwhile, Leah keeps on pumping out kid after kid after kid, right? And Rachel struggles. And so he ends up having some other kids with some other women too. You got to read the Bible. I don't want to get into all that. Okay, so let's just say there's several other women, a lot of other kids. Well, eventually, after a long, long battles of infertility, finally, Rachel has a baby, a boy, no less. What do you think that boy's name's going to be? Joseph. That's who we're focusing in on. Now, I know when you read through the scriptures, and you read about this whole multiple women thing and polygamy, and you're like, it's hard reading the Bible because so much of it doesn't really relate in a different culture. There's nothing really like that in today's culture. And I go, wait, pause for just 1 minute. Let's sort of look at our cultural comparison that we have in our culture. Are there some of us in this room who grew up in a family where we have multiple children who come from different mothers or different fathers? What do we call that? We call that a blended family or a step family. There's all different kinds of blended family, step family, adopted family. We have all kinds of those dynamics, right? Well, what you're going to find is, and by the way, I don't care what your blended family is. If you don't know anything about blended families are always hard. There's no such thing as an easy blended family. I had what I thought was the easiest blended family you could possibly imagine, where I had a wife who passed away and I married somebody who didn't have kids. I thought, what could be an easier blended family than that? They're always hard. Every blended family is hard. And the more complex the blended family is, the more difficult the blended family is. Can I get an amen from someone in the room? Yes. Okay. So what you have here is an ancient equivalent of a blended family. You've got multiple kids from multiple marriages. Now, in our own time, oftentimes what ends up happening, let's just say, I'm going to talk not as you as parents of blended families, I'm going to talk to these siblings that grew up in blended families. Do you ever get the feeling as though there's one child in the family who is loved by the parents more than everybody else? If favoritism is an issue in a normal, whatever you might call a normal, typical nuclear family with one mom, one dad, and two kids, if you think favoritism is an issue there, you don't know nothing until you get to a blended family. And if you're in a blended family, you don't know nothing until you're in a blended family where mother and father, the Brady Bunch, come together. Now picture, if you don't know what a blended family is, think Brady Bunch, okay? So here's a story of a man named Brady, you know, bring up boys, bring up girls. Now what if the Bradys had a baby together? Anybody think that that child just might become the favorite amongst all the Brady kids? Yeah. That's who Joseph was, okay? If you want to know Joseph's dynamic, that's who he was. Because he was the child from the woman, the only woman that Jacob ever really wanted to marry in the first place. All these other kids were just all these other kids. This is the one I always wanted to have. Now, she ends up having another boy. Rachel has another boy, Benjamin. And you might say, well, wasn't he loved just as much? Almost. The issue with Benjamin, though, is Rachel actually dies giving birth to Benjamin. And so you can imagine there's probably always some sort of maybe cloud over Benjamin because, you know, he has Benjamin, but it was at the cost of the love of his life. And so what ends up happening with Jacob is the love that he has for Rachel sort of gets transferred and now placed onto Joseph, right? He's the firstborn of the woman he truly loved, and, you know, he's his hope, he's his future, and he's all he has left, so to speak, in his mind of the woman he loved, Rachel. And so that sort of sets the stage as what we're about to read here. So, Genesis 37. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending flocks with his brothers. Now, these are, it says, his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel, now, by the way, remember, if you remember from our last couple stories on this, Jacob's name was changed to Israel by God. And so in the narrative in Genesis, the author will interchange the name Jacob and Israel interchangeably without notice. So if you read Israel, he's talking about Jacob, not the nation. Okay, so it says, now Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, as I've already explained kind of why that was. Because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made an ornate robe for him. And when his brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than any of them, they hated them and could not speak a kind word to him. Now, when you read this, it's sort of, now if you already have a notion of Joseph in his later life, you read this and you think, well, you know, Joseph's just kind of a victim here, isn't he? I mean, you know, it's not his fault that his dad loved him more than the other kids. It's not his fault, right? Ask his brothers if they felt that way, by the way. It's not his fault, right? And it's his father who gives him the robe and kind of like creates the whole situation for him. So Joseph's just sort of like, you know, the wrong guy in the wrong place. Except for if you read the text and you really understand what you're reading, you'll begin to see there's some textual clues in here that says, before you go so fast, Joseph wasn't that good of a guy either. Now, when it said in there, this phrase, and Joseph gave a bad report about his brothers. I know what you're thinking. I know what you've probably heard preached before on this, that, you know, Joseph was a tattletale, and when he saw his brothers acting up, he went back and told daddy what his brothers were doing, so he was sort of like the favorite goody-two-shoe boy. Well, that might be okay, except for if you really research what this word that's translated bad report, how else it's used in the scriptures, you'll see that it's a little bit more colorful of a term. We see it several other times. You see it over in the book of Numbers. Moses sends 12 spies into the land, to come back and say, we can do this. If God is for us, it doesn't matter who's against us. 10 spies, though, give a bad report, and they spread a bad report amongst the people. So, was it an accurate report, or was it a sort of fictitious, made-up, false story? I don't know. Well, let's look at some other instances. Over in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah gets really frustrated with God. He says, God, you called me to be a prophet. I'm doing everything you asked me to do, and it's not working out like I thought it would. Everybody's rejecting me. I feel like, God, I feel like you've deceived me. I go out there, and I do good things, yet people spread a bad report about me. In other words, what he's saying is they're making up false stories about my life to harm me. So that's another way that word is used. We also see it very clearly over in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 18. Or it says this, whoever conceals hatred with lying lips and spreads slander is a fool. I didn't hear the word bad report in there. I know, it's because there it's translated as slander, which is what the word really is talking about. So let's go back now with that context and reread, and Joseph spread a bad report about his brothers. Or what if it said, and Joseph slandered his brothers? So we don't like that. We don't like that rendering because we think of Joseph as a good guy. But what is the text actually saying? It's using a word here, not of, and Joseph let his father know the bad thing his brothers were up to. That's not what it says. It says Joseph is out making up lies about his brother to make the brothers look bad and make himself look even better. Now, is that a good guy or a bad guy? Now, don't go, well, I don't know, maybe. Do you like it when somebody does that about you at work? Do you like it when somebody makes up a false story about you and tells the boss that you did something you didn't do? Hey, you hear Jim, he lost the company $1 million. No, I didn't. Well, I guess it wasn't that bad what she said about me. No, that's a bad thing, right? So the brothers hate him for the fact that he's spreading lies about them, as you can imagine they would. The brothers also hate him because, let's face it, the father favors him and he gives him this special coat, which isn't really made for working out in the field. And so the brothers are out working out in the field doing manual labor. Meanwhile, Joseph, very similar to Esau, sort of gets a free pass on the hard labor and work, gets to do whatever he wants to do. He sort of like puts Joseph in this management kind of position. And keep in mind, Joseph is the second youngest of all the brothers. Okay, so he's putting the second youngest sort of in charge or in the supervisory role over all the other brothers, not having to do any of the work. Don't you get frustrated when it feels like you're doing more chores around the house than your brother or sister? Can I get an amen from some teenager in the room? Right? Well, that's how they felt growing up with Joseph. So, so then it goes on, which says, so his brothers hate him because Joseph slanders him. They hate him because his father clearly shows favoritism towards him, doesn't make him doing work. But then we also see this other thing about the dreams in verse 5. It says, now Joseph had a dream, and he went and told his brothers about it, and they hated him all the more because of it. So here's what happens. He says, hey, guys, listen to this dream I had. Well, here's what it was. We were all out working in the field, and they're thinking, whoa, you were out working in the field? Well, okay, I'm all ears for this one. Okay, so we're all out working in the field. That would be a new thing. All right, so we're all bundling up these sheaves of grain, and mine stood upright. but all of yours kept falling over, as though they were bowing down to mine. What do y'all think? Yeah, they thought the same thing you would think if you were told that dream. And then they look at me like, what? Are you saying you're going to rule over us? You actually think you're going to rule over us? And says they hated him all the more because of the dream that he shared with them. Well, then he has another dream, and he tells this dream to his brothers. Hey, guys, I had another dream. This time, the sun and the moon and 11 stars. How many brothers does Joseph have? 11. So the sun and the moon and 11 stars, almost like as if mom and dad, the sun and the moon, and all you 11 stars were all, guess what? Bowing down to me. It says, now when he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what's this dream you think you had? You really think your mother and I and all your brothers are going to come bow down before you? And his brothers were all the more jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now, it's hard to understand the full weight of what just happened here because in our society, we don't live in an honor society. In an honor-shame society, it's different than our culture. So like, for instance, if your teenager came home and said, Dad, you don't got to worry about working anymore. I'm going to be a rock star. YouTube's going to make me a millionaire. I'm going to be somebody. You're just going to be glad someday. You know me, right? It's exactly. Your reaction would be to laugh. You'd be like, all right, son, well, buy me a house. You know, go for it, right? That we would laugh that off because to us, that would almost be humorous. In an honor culture, that is about the most disrespectful thing you could possibly do. That is extremely shameful. You would have a very irate response from a parent if you were to say that. In a lot of Asian cultures today who still echo the same honor culture, you don't say things like that to your elders, your parents, or your older brothers and siblings or elders in the community. That would be extremely disrespectful and make you an object of scorn and shame to everybody around you, okay? So you know it was so egregious, okay? Keep in mind, let's go back to you as siblings who had the picture back. So you're a sibling, you're in a blended family, and there's the favorite child. What does it take for your parents to actually reprimand the golden child? Like, how bad do they have to mess up before your parents actually say something, right? Like, for you, you forget anything, and your parents unload on you, right? But they can get away with anything, right? Did you notice in here that Joseph came and rebuked him? That's the strongest kind of correction. Gets in his face and calls him out on this. The author is trying to point out the golden child, who never does anything wrong, is being severely reprimanded. Okay, that's how egregious this whole thing was. Once again, is Joseph a good dude? No. The text is trying to show you he's slandering his brothers, and he's got arrogance that's so extreme in their culture that even the golden child gets rebuked for how he's acting and behaving. Okay, now, I have to set all that up to ask this question. You can see the dysfunction going, and I didn't even get to the other dysfunction that happens before this chapter, all right? Let me just give you a little preview of what you've already missed in chapters 35, 6, and 7. We're just going to skip over to get to this point. Earlier, you got Simeon and Levi, two of his older brothers. Their sister was raped, and so they did what any of you all would do. They set it up and murder the whole family that commits the rape. Also, leading up to this chapter, Reuben, who's the firstborn, he ends up, let's see, what did he do? Oh, yeah, he Jerry Springered with one of his dad's wives. Jerry, yeah. That's what's happened before this, okay? And by the way, I also want to set something up in here. When I told you the story about Joseph sharing the dream, right, I know what you were picturing, too. I know you were picturing little Joey coming down, telling his brothers around the kitchen table about his dream, right? Over Cheerios. Guys, guess what God told me last night? How old was Joseph when this narrative starts? 17. And he was the second youngest of all the brothers. The brothers who were out sleeping with dad's wife and murdering villages. Okay? I.e., his brothers are somewhere between the ages of 18 and 40. These are grown adults that he's saying this to. These are really bad dudes. Okay, so take that context. What do you do if you're in God's situation? Now, the whole world is literally going to hell in a handbasket. You've got Abraham, who is his family has like the last glimmer of faith in a relationship with you. which are trying to fan the flame of this relationship between you and Abraham such that you can use this as a way to be a light to the nations, that you can bless Abraham and his family so that all nations can be blessed through it, that people would see the relationship the two of you all had, and this would spread throughout the world, that all the world would come back into a right relationship with God. And how is it going so far? Well, to Isaac, we already talked about the train wreck that was, and then the Jacob, and we're seeing the train wreck that his family is, and now you've got his sons, and you've already got murder, and you've got incest, and now like the one bright beacon of hope is this kid Joseph, who we've got a lot of promise in, and now where's he at? He's not going down a good path either. What do you do if you're God? Just play God for a second. What do? How do you change the circumstance? Now, when I asked you to play God, some of you were like, well, I don't know. I'm not God. I can't do that. You know, it's funny you would say that now. Because when God is God in your life, you ask a question with the premise of, okay, God, you did it again, okay? I'm trying to be patient here. But if you would just call me before you go and do things without thinking, we could have handled this a lot better. Now, your prayer doesn't sound like that. It sounds like, why? God, why? Come on, come on. Why are you letting this happen? Right? And what is the context? Seriously, God, we could have handled this a lot better. If you talk to me, I got a lot of ideas on how this could have worked out a lot better than what you've done. Right? Okay. So once again, play God. Intervene in the life of this dysfunctional family and correct things. Have at it. Okay. Since you have no ideas, let's see what God did. Now, his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, which is, by the way, my favorite city in the entire Old Testament because I like saying Shechem. So, now keep in mind, when you read these locations, they're in there for a reason because you can go back to now and see where these places are. And Shechem is not like they were grazing over by Lynn Haven Mall, okay? This is like they were grazing up in Hampton, okay? And then he goes to Hampton looking for them, and they're in Dothan, so he ends up having to go all the way to Williamsburg, okay? These are far distances. This isn't just like over the next hill, okay? These are far distances. So it says, the brothers had gone out to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Jacob says to Joseph, hey, as you know, your brothers are grazing their flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. Once again, here's Joseph in this managerial type of role. He's not doing the hard labor. The brothers are out tending the flocks, and he sends his brother out there to sort of check up on them. Very well, Joseph replied. And so he said to them, so Jacob says to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. Now, I'm sure the brothers loved having Joseph, the slanderer, be the one to report. So he sent them off towards the valley of from the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, he found a man wandering around in the fields, and he asked him, hey, what are you looking for? He says, oh, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing the flocks? Oh, they've moved on from here, he answered. He says, I actually heard them say, let's go down to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers, and he found them near Dothan. But they saw him when he was off in the distance. And before Joseph reached them, they plotted to kill him. Oh, here comes that dreamer, they said to one another. Come on now, let's kill him and throw him in one of these cisterns and then go back and tell Dad a ferocious animal ate him. Then we'll see what comes of this guy's dreams. Remember, these are really bad dudes. So what ends up happening is they do just that. They throw him in the cistern, plotting to kill him. What ends up happening, though, is some slave traders happen to be passing through the area on their way to Egypt. One of them gets the bright idea and says, hey, you know, if we kill him, you know, we'll kind of have that whole guilt on our hands. What if we sold him as a slave, goes off to Egypt, we'll never see him again. We'll just tell Dad that we killed him, but then we don't have the guilt of having actually killed him, and we'll profit out of it. We'll make money off of selling the guy. What could be better than that? So that's exactly what they do. They sell Joseph as a slave to Egypt, and so Joseph gets carted off to Egypt. He ends up over in Egypt. He works for this guy named Potiphar. That's where the whole thing, Potiphar's wife makes his passes at him. Joseph says, I'm not going to do this, and you know what happens? Potiphar's wife gives a bad report about Joseph. Oh, it's funny how these things keep coming back around. And Joseph gets thrown in jail for it. And so then Joseph spends like the next 12, 14 years in prison. He helps people out that forget him and don't, you know, pay back the goodness that he shows to them. And then eventually, he ends up getting out of jail and talking with the king of Egypt, who ends up making him prime minister because he says, hey, king, a famine's coming. You better make a plan for it. And the king says, well, you seem like the only guy with a plan, so you run this whole thing. And that's kind of what happens to Joseph's life down the path. But all of that gets set off right here. 14 years of problems. Now, did he deserve to have all that happen? Odd question, right? Like, on the one hand, he kind of had it coming to him, right? Right? I mean, he wasn't innocent in the matter. He's lying about his brothers, right? He's arrogantly showing off all these dreams. So the reasons why his brothers hate him wasn't just because he was a favorite. He was also doing some of these things, right? So, and the reason why I say this, because sometimes, now, I will admit, the punishment does not fit the crime, okay? Like, he doesn't deserve to spend 14 years of his life as a prisoner and as a slave in a foreign country simply for being a little arrogant and lying. Okay, I mean, if that happened to all of us, God help us, right? So I can say that it's a little more severe. But I also just want to point out, sometimes we'll look at God and say, God, this is so unfair. But can we just pause for a second and say, but yeah, but sometimes you had a part in this, okay? It wasn't like you're completely innocent. Now, I'm not saying you're to blame. I'm not saying this is always the case, but sometimes we act like as if we're far more innocent than we are. Let me just begin with that. But I also got to come back in and say and point out here that this also didn't all just happen because of what Joseph had done. Did you notice the God moments in the story? They're easy to miss, right? Joseph goes looking for his brothers where? In Shechem. All right, but they're not in Shechem. They're in Dothan, right? How does Joseph find that out? There just happens to be a guy that he runs into who just happened to hear his brothers were headed to Dothan. Now, think about how random that whole thing, random, I'm using air quotes if you can't see me online, I mean, how random that is. That's, you know, because if you had said, oh, I saw your brothers here a while ago, I don't know where they went. But he just happened to hear them say, let's go to Dothan. So, do you think this is a coincidence, or do you think God is ordaining Joseph ending up running into his brothers that day, right? I mean, had God not somehow intervened with the random coincidence of the moment, Joseph would have gone to Shechem, not found him, gone back to dad and said, I don't know where they went. And none of this may have ever happened. However, did Joseph have it coming to him? Yes. But did God play a part in it? Yes. Okay. All right. Pause the story there for a minute. I got to get back to the opening video. I've showed that video once or twice before. I think it was at least 5 years ago before I showed it last time. About 5 years, I'll repeat stuff because I figure some of y'all haven't been here that long. I both love and hate that movie, Coupe de Ville. Any of y'all ever seen it? Yeah, maybe only one or two people in the room. It wasn't a very good movie. And that's the problem with it. You know when you're watching a movie and it starts off kind of like it's interesting, and then you get about an hour into it and you're like, this is going nowhere. Like, and then you're like, well, I've got an hour invested in it. Maybe there'll be something that kind of wraps all this up and makes sense, right? What happens 99.99% of the time? You realize instead of losing 1 hour of your life, you lost 2 hours of your life, right? Except that movie. That movie is the movie that gives you hope for all other movies. That movie is to blame for why you keep watching these other movies, hoping that, you know, beyond hope, when there's no reason to hope, that maybe it'll have an ending like that. What happens in this movie, as you sort of saw the end of it, is these three brothers, I don't know if you really couldn't tell from the scene, but these three brothers are oil and water. They are complete opposites. You know, you got one who is, I think, a Marine or in the military. The other one is a draft dodger who hates the military. The other one sort of tries to keep the peace, but has gone the business route. And so one guy doesn't want to work, and this guy thinks you just should work. This guy thinks you should work for the government. And they're going back and forth. They never liked each other. They literally graduated high school, parted ways, never talked again. This is not the age of the internet and phone, you know, whatever. They just don't ever talk. So for the mother's birthday, he says, hey, why don't you guys, you know, we can't afford plane tickets, so here, I got this car. I'm going to give your mother for a birthday present. You know, he tells the oldest, the responsible one, the military one, go pick up your two brothers, drive down to Florida for your mother's birthday. And so they do, and they just argue the whole time. And that's why the movie is so laboriously, it's like, you know, there's enough drama in real life, I don't want to sit and watch it for an hour, you know? It's just argument after argument, and it's like, why am I watching these people argue? I could turn off the TV and let my kids go at it, you know? I don't want to listen to this, right? So you watch the whole thing, and of course they wreck the car, and it's just bad thing after bad thing after bad thing happens. And they get down there and they think, oh, you know, this was the car that mom had. And he's like, no, what does he say? It's not about the car. We all got together. we all got together. This, if you're the dad and you've got this dysfunctional family, how do you heal it? How do you heal it? What he ends up doing is he ends up putting them in a miserable situation, which you all have to watch for an hour and a half of the movie, okay? I can't stress that enough. They bring you along with the misery, okay? Really good job of emotionally bringing you in. So we put you through this, you know, miserable experience and trial of them driving from like Maine all the way down to Florida. That's a long drive, right? You know, why? In the hopes that the trial will bond them and heal the dysfunction in their relationship. The Joseph you know is the Joseph that was healed and shaped through the trials that happened over that 14-year period of mistreatment and, you know, injustice all along the way. And all along the way, you might go, God, why? And all along, God is shaping and molding Joseph into the man that he wants him to be. But he can't do that as the favored child under Jacob. He just becomes a spoiled, rotten brat the same way Esau was. And God can't let that happen. And so God allows him by sovereign purposes, some of its own purposes. He got himself into that. He made some of his own choices. And then God also sovereignly interacts to move him to that situation, to make him into the person that you look to and go, wow, Joseph, we want the result. We just don't want the process or the trial. But that's not completely what the story's about either, though. You see, and that's also the problem. Sometimes we go, why God? But part of that premise is, what is the story? You know, from Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, what's this whole, who's the central character of the narrative? What? Joseph, right? No. In the same way you think you're the central character of your narrative, no. And when the credits roll on earth over the existence, you are like hot dog vendor number 3. You think you're the first name coming up on the credits because this life was a movie all about you. No. You're an extra. At best, you'll get credited as hot dog vendor number 3. Okay? Ooh, look, my name was in it. But if you live this life thinking it's all about you, and you're going to ask God, why did this happen to me? Pause for a second. Do you realize that back in Genesis 12, God says, Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. However, I can't give it to you right now because to give it to you right now would be unfair and unjust to the people who are living in it now because they live here. But one day, about 400 years from now, their sin is going to be so great that I will not be able to withhold my justice and my correction from them. And so I will bring you back to this land in 400 years, and I will use you as an instrument of my justice to punish the people for the sin that they're committing. But I'm a lot more patient than you can imagine, and it's going to take 400 years before I reach my boiling point on that. So you got this issue in Genesis 12 where I've got to allow Abraham and his family to grow into a nation, but I can't let them do it here. Furthermore, there's a famine coming, and the famine is going to kill everybody in the land or you know, severely decimate the population, and I can't let that happen to Jacob and his family. And so I allow Joseph to end up in Egypt through a circumstances that we just read about, where he ultimately becomes a prime minister, which puts him in a position of power such that when Jacob's family comes down begging for food in Egypt, who's in charge of the whole food program? Joseph, who can then provide food for the family, and now God has a place where the people can grow and populate, so eventually then he can use Moses as a salvific figure to then lead the people out of Egypt and into the promised land. And so Joseph plays a key part in the whole narrative of everything that God is doing. Isn't that amazing? Oh, but I thought the story was about Joseph and his character development. Is it really? Or is this about what God is doing to redeem all of humanity and the part that Joseph plays in it? You see, if you look at your trials and you try to ask, what did I do to get myself into all of this? Well, I can trace a few things, but that doesn't explain everything that happened. Well, God seems to sovereignly be acting to do all this to me. Why is God doing this to me? Well, maybe he is developing you. Maybe he is growing you. But maybe, just maybe also, maybe it has nothing to do with you. Maybe he's got a bigger picture in mind. And do you think Joseph ever understood all of this stuff? No. Do you think Joseph ever knew that Jesus also would be sold out for pieces of silver? He would also be mistreated and falsely accused? I don't think he also understood he was being a picture of Jesus Christ someday. I don't think he understood any of that. He just asked God the question of why. And you know what phrase keeps coming up in the narrative of Joseph as we go through the story? I don't have time to cover it, so I'm just going to tell you. This little phrase keeps coming up. But the Lord was with Joseph. Oh, another bad thing happened to him, but the Lord was with Joseph. Another bad thing happened, but the Lord was with Joseph. What happens is that Joseph goes from being the favorite child who has everything given to him to having nothing but God. And in the process of having nothing but God, he relies on God and becomes the person God wants him to be. And in the process, he's able to commit his will to God, and God uses him to be the very figure that pulls his people out of there and accomplishes his plan. And so later on in life, Joseph says this in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. His life comes to this crescendo when he says this to his brothers: what you guys meant for evil in sending me to Egypt, God used for good to save many. I can begin to see a glimpse of what God is doing. My hope is that wherever you're at on this path, that you would trust that God is with you in this process. It might be because of your own doing. It might be because God sovereignly acted to put you in this place as you go through difficult times. God will use this to shape and mold you, but maybe that's also not his chief priority in the process. Yes, he will use it to do that if you allow it, but maybe, just maybe, he has a bigger picture and plan that maybe you will never fully be able to comprehend. Maybe it won't be till you sit with God in eternity and he goes back over your whole life story and you go, oh, yeah, I really hated you for all that stuff, God, but I'm so glad you did it. And what you're going to see next week is the healing that finally happens in this dysfunctional family. And it doesn't happen until on the other side of all of this stuff. So maybe, just maybe, the healing you want isn't happening by the means you thought was going to get you there. Would you want to close our time in prayer? Father, I thank you, Father, for this story of Joseph and the greater narrative and how it all fits. I love being able to sit in your perspective and be able to look back over someone's life and say, oh, God, I see what you did there. Oh, now I really see what you did there. Because, God, in my life, I struggle to know what you're doing right now. For some in this room, we're still at the why God moment. We're still wishing you would consult us before you allow things to happen. We're still frustrated because it seems like as if the punishment doesn't fit our crimes. But Father, may we trust that you are with us during this season. May we trust, Lord, that you will use anything that comes into our life, any adversity that's thrown at us, any slander that is used against us, can all be used for your glory, for your good, to accomplish your purposes, that you truly do work all things together for the good. So Father, may we trust you through this, but also realize, Father, that this may not be about us in the end. Everything I go through, Father, may simply be because you want me to say one word to one person someday when I'm 60 years old and have you say, that's it, that's all I needed all of that for. And if, God, if that's it, if that's what you're calling me to do, sign me up and give me the faith to walk this path with you. And in Jesus' name we pray, amen.